Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
What's remarkable about this new fragment that we found, the Gospel of Jesus' wife, is that it actually has Jesus saying, "My wife." We've had these other texts, especially a text called the Gospel of Philip, and in addition to that, the Gospel of Mary, that have talked about this close relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Why is it that we have been pushing against that so hard? I think it's because it's very difficult when you have spent your whole life, when you've spent, in fact, Christianity has spent 1,500 years or more talking about, understanding Jesus not being married, to actually know it when we see it, so to speak.
That's Dr. Karen King of Harvard Divinity School talking about what at the time was purporting to be an ancient manuscript of, and it's actually called the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, a little piece of papyrus with some Greek letters on it, some wording there. It read as plainly as she said it did, talking about Jesus describing someone as his wife. It has since been determined to be a rather sophisticated forgery. We're going to be talking about that with Dr. Ben Witherington here in the first few minutes of Issues Etc. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Thursday afternoon, June the 16th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. A little bit later, Dr. Adam Francisco joins us. We're going to talk about the Quran and homosexuality. We will review the movie The Conjuring 2 with Pastor Ted Giese a little later in Hour 2 of Issues Etc. Then Terry Mattingly, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, will join us. We'll talk about media coverage of the annual meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention in St. Louis. Now, you can join us for the next 2 hours with your questions and your comments, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc. Our beloved on-demand listeners, whenever, wherever you listen, use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about a forgery of a manuscript called The Gospel of Jesus' Wife, Dr. Ben Witherington, professor of New Testament for doctoral studies at Asbury Theological Seminary and author of more than 40 books, including The Jesus Quest and The Paul Quest. Dr. Witherington, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you.
When this story first broke about the discovery of this alleged Gospel of Jesus' Wife, you were approached by the media and you were skeptical. Why?
Well, the issue of all these kinds of finds is provenance, by which I mean, where was it found, in what context, and how was it found? Well, this is an unprovenanced artifact. We have no idea where it came from. We don't know how many hands or whose hands it's passed through. This is not like the Nag Hammadi scrolls that were found in a waste dump in Egypt. We don't know where this document came from. And there's a reason for immediate suspicion if you don't know the provenance of an artifact. And so that was certainly one of the main reasons. But even if it was a genuine artifact, what we know about early Christianity is there were no Gnostic Christians in the first century A.D. So we're talking about a sectarian group of Christians in the 3rd or 4th century, at best, late 2nd century. And by then, the church was predominantly Gentile, not Jewish. Gnosticism is not a Jewish movement. It has to do with a Gentile reflection and aberration of the original Jewish gospel. And so not only the character of the document, but also the provenance of the document suggested that this was likely a forgery.
What were some claiming that it was? What did they say this thing was supposed to be?
Well, Karen King was fairly careful about what she was prepared to claim. Not at the outset, but later she was very clear. I don't think this tells us anything about the historical Jesus himself or his historical relationships with Mary Magdalene. What it tells us about is a sect of early Christians who may have thought Jesus was married. But this is such a tiny fragment that I don't think you could even deduce that from it. I mean, we have a line in this fragment that says, "My wife said Jesus, dot, dot, dot." Well, you can fill in the blanks a lot of ways. The rest of that sentence could read, "My wife said Jesus, if I had one." You know, we don't know. We don't even have a whole sentence there. So all of this kind of rather rampant speculation based on a very fragmented document. The speculation was, the manuscript was full of holes, and the speculation was full of holes.
It turns out, at least according to the lengthy Atlantic story that was written recently about basically trying to track down what its real provenance was, whose hands it was in and where did it come from, if they could answer even that last question. It does turn out to at least seem to be a rather elaborate, maybe even a sophisticated forgery. Why would someone go to all the trouble of getting a hold of a genuinely ancient piece of papyrus and then, in this case, perhaps mixing up ink according to kind of ancient recipes that would have no kind of traces of modern production in them to produce something like this?
Well, I think the story is pretty revealing. In fact, I read it this morning, and what you get the sense of towards the end of a very lengthy story is that the person in question who turned this document over to Karen King, Mr. Fritz, in fact, has an agenda, and his agenda is that the notion that of Orthodox Christianity, that Jesus was a single person and that he didn't have any sort of intimate relationship with Mary Magdalene, unlike what the fiction of the Da Vinci Code taught us, he doesn't like the Orthodox picture. He much prefers the notion that the Gnostic Christians represented early Christianity more accurately than the earlier Orthodox Christian documents. And he, in fact, goes so far as to suggest that the Gnostic Gospels are the original Gospels, and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which were written in the first century A.D., misrepresent the truth about Jesus. Now, I honestly don't know any scholars, not even Karen King, not even Elaine Pagels at Princeton, who think that the Gnostic Gospels are earlier than the canonical Gospels. So, I mean, this is just sort of wish fulfillment on the part of Mr. Fritz, as far as I can see.
Is there, to kind of put it crassly, is there a profit motive sometimes in...
Well, sometimes there is. I mean, obviously, the selling of antiquities and artifacts can produce considerable profit. But in this case, it seems to be the case, and we don't know for sure, it seems to be the case that the real motive for doing this was to present us with a very different view of the origins of Christianity.
Let's talk a little bit about that issue of provenance. And these are difficult things to establish. And I imagine it would not be a rare occurrence that a papyrus, a fragment of a manuscript from, say, a genuinely biblical text, a Gospel of John or something, would fall into the hands of a university or a collector, and everybody wants it to be genuine, but it lacks that provenance. It seems to fit all the bills, but you can't say, it must be a frustrating situation indeed to say, unfortunately, this has passed through the hands of a number of dealers.
Right. Well, and here's the real problem more than that. The real problem is we have lots of not fully or properly provenanced artifacts that are probably genuine. Okay? We have a lot of those kinds of things out there. And the question is, are we going to simply dismiss the possible authenticity of all of them on the basis of we don't know where it came from? Or are we going to analyze these things and then discuss that, right? We have the same kind of issue with the James Ossuary because we're not exactly sure where where it came from. We know it came from Jerusalem, but that's not a very specific spot, you know. And so some archaeologists like Eric and Carol Myers from Duke have been adamant that we just put on hold any discussion of unprovenanced artifacts, and we don't do any detailed analysis of them. Well, that's unrealistic, because the truth of the matter is that probably 30 or 40% of the genuine artifacts from antiquity are unprovenanced. We didn't dig them up. We don't know where they were in situ. We don't know what monastery it came out of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if it's a document. So it is a debate in the scholarly world about what to do about this. But this manuscript in particular has all of the telltale signs, if I'm going to put it that way, of being a modern composition. It's written in Coptic, a language which is not Greek. It uses Greek letters, but it's not Greek. It's an Egyptian language, and there are two kinds of Coptic. There's Sahidic and there's Boharic. But there are problems. There are grammar mistakes. There are telltale signs that, on the one hand, the piece of papyrus seems to be a sophisticated forgery. On the other hand, it seems to be rather clumsy. Now, what kind of person in antiquity would make those kind of mistakes? Well, that doesn't seem very likely. Literacy was very low in antiquity, so the people who actually composed documents were literate, and they didn't tend to make these kinds of mistakes. So it's more likely we're dealing with an amateur in modernity who doesn't really know Coptic as well as he should and has made some mistakes.
Is there some connection to the Gospel of Thomas? I seem to remember something from the Atlantic story that there is even a typographical error, so to speak,
spelling error,
something like that, that indicates it may have been copied from an edition of the Gospel of Thomas.
Yes, there is a bit in there that seems to be a simple copy of Thomas. And Francis Watson, in a lengthy article that was either in JTS or NTS, New Testament Studies, demonstrated the dependency of this fragment on some material in a particular manuscript of the Gospel of Thomas. Now, what we can say about the Gospel of Thomas is it also is not a first century document. It's a second century document that reflects the final editing of all four canonical Gospels, which could not have happened before the 2nd century A.D. So that indeed means that this fragment, at best, would be from the 3rd or 4th century. And let's say it's genuine. It's so fragmentary that I don't think you could draw any dramatic conclusions on the basis of it. But here's the thing. There are lots of scholars out there who deeply dislike the Orthodox picture of the rise of early Christianity, and would like to suggest that early Christianity was kind of a free-for-all. There were all kinds of views of Jesus. There were all kinds of trends and sects, and there were all kinds of views out there. And Orthodoxy didn't come till much later, like imposed maybe by Constantine, as Dan Brown suggested. Well, this is a theory that has no historical merit. It really doesn't. The disagreements in early Christianity were about praxis. Did Gentiles need to be circumcised in order to be Christians? Did they need to keep the Mosaic covenant in order to be Christians? These were issues of orthopraxy, not orthodoxy. What our earliest Pauline letter, Galatians, tells us straight up that Paul and James and Peter and John agreed on what Paul was going to preach to the Gentiles, and they shook on it, right? The issue was not theology. It was, how then shall we integrate Gentiles into a Jewish movement of the followers of Jesus? That was the issue. The issue was not an aberrant theology like Gnosticism, which suggested that the body was evil and that the spirit was good, or had a view of multiple deities, a good deity who was all spirit and a bad deity that created the material world, which is Gnosticism. So there are, unfortunately, a lot of scholars who are not happy with the traditional view of the rise and origins of Christianity and its orthodoxy. And so they have touted all these Gnostic documents to suggest that there was always a great complexity to early Christianity, and you can't say that one group is heretical and another is orthodox, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, unfortunately, you can, and it's just that these scholars don't like the facts.
Dr. Ben Witherington is our guest. He'll be with us for a few minutes on the other side of the break. He's professor of New Testament for doctoral studies at Asbury Theological Seminary and author of more than 40 books, including The Jesus Quest and The Paul Quest. We talk to the biggest names in religion today, liberal bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took five loaves and two fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity, Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues, etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, etc.
The church's music from the second century. The 6th century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Ben Witherington is our guest. We're talking about an ancient manuscript called The Gospel of Jesus' Wife. At least it was believed by some to be an ancient manuscript until recently shown to be a sophisticated forgery. He's professor of New Testament for doctoral studies at Asbury Theological Seminary. Dr. Witherington, let's talk a little bit about that Gospel of Thomas that ties into this story. Now, we are talking about a genuinely ancient document and production, aren't we?
Yeah. Absolutely. I would say it's probably from Syria. It seems to have a Syrian provenance if you read it carefully. It's probably from the late 2nd century. It's really a kind of potpourri kind of document. I mean, the author of this document, the compiler of this document, has access to various of the Synoptic Gospels, and probably some sayings from the Gospel of John as well, and some other material. and the other material, it seems to be real proto-Gnostic speculations. There's a particularly famous saying towards the end of the Gospel of Thomas, where the disciples are complaining about Mary Magdalene. How can she be a close disciple of Jesus? And we all know that only males are going to be saved. And Jesus says, not to worry, boys, we'll make her a male. This does not sound like the canonical Gospels at all. So it's kind of a potpourri that has some of the earlier sayings of Jesus, some genuine sayings of Jesus, and some much later things added to the pot.
So what we have there is a Gnostic sect of Christianity that exists in various places, and that it is producing its own documents, putting its own spin, if you will, on the existing and circulating New Testament documents.
That's correct. And part of it has to do with the rise of asceticism in early Christianity, both in its orthodox forms and in its not-so-orthodox forms. Gnosticism really was a highly ascetical movement in various ways. It really had issues with human sexuality, it had issues with intercourse, it had issues with even physicality in some of the extreme forms of Gnosticism. It said matter was evil and spirit is good in its fully developed form. Now, you're not already there in the Gospel of Thomas. You have to go much further than that, like the Gospel of the Savior or some of the later Gospels, like the Gospel of Mary or the Gospel of Philip. But it's really sort of turning a Jewish gospel about a risen Jesus and about an eschatological gospel about future resurrection into what I would call Gnostic soup for the soul. You know, it's a spiritualizing of the message of Jesus in a way that would be palatable by Gentiles who have read a lot of Plato and that sort of stuff.
What's the fascination, the scholarly fascination, with these texts? You mentioned that there is a kind of a thread in scholarship that is more or less hostile toward orthodoxy, the orthodox version of Christianity.
Well, Christianity is a historical religion, and so it stands or falls on certain important historical claims, like Jesus died on a cross and rose again from the dead, okay? And because it's a historical religion, it's always subject to historical scrutiny and interpretation of the original historical facts in various forms. And so the part of the fascination is the quite right concern of scholars that let's recognize and be honest about the diversity in early Christianity. Okay, that's a fair point. The question is, does the diversity we find in the late 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, which is a very wide spectrum of diversity, does that reflect the theology of the persons who wrote our canonical scriptures? Does it reflect the theology and ethics of the earliest Jewish Christian followers of Jesus, including Paul? And the answer to that is largely no. But because there is a deep dissatisfaction with that answer, a lot of scholars have said, well, you know, maybe it's not as clear-cut as that. Maybe there was, from the beginning, no actual orthodoxy. There was just a variety, you know, a buffet of different kinds of early Christianities, plural. And I would say that's an argument from silence. Because when you read our earliest Christian documents, both in the New Testament and documents like First Clement or the Shepherd of Hermas or the Didache, genuine early Christian documents, there is absolutely no evidence of a trend like Gnosticism in the earliest form of Christianity. It's just that some scholars, you know, are interested in coming up with something new, and they've not been satisfied with the old answers. That's part of it.
Is there a lesson here for biblical scholars in general? And that is, it appears, you know, that Karen King there at Harvard Divinity School kind of was given something that she wanted to find all along, perhaps. Is there a lesson here about the caution, not only with regard to the genuineness of these things, but kind of finding what you're looking for?
Well, exactly. That's exactly right. One of the big lessons, I would say, that comes from this whole cautionary tale is that when you want something so badly to be true, even when the strongest evidence suggests it is not, you open yourself up to all kinds of uncritical thinking, all kinds of naivete. When you want something so desperately to be true, you open yourself up to being convinced about things that otherwise you would never be convinced of if you were thinking critically about such things. And so, absolutely, yes. I mean, I think that's the big lesson of this. Even very credible, highly learned, intelligent scholars, when they find something that really deeply resonates with what they were hoping to be true, watch out, because all kinds of things become possible under those kinds of circumstances.
With that said, and coupled with the fact that you pointed out earlier that a lot of the ancient text manuscript that we have for both canonical and non-canonical texts lacks that connection of providence. With that said, can we still look at this branch of textual criticism with some confidence? Is it still a solid science, so to speak?
Well, I would say it's more of an art than a science. Now, you know, there's a scientific side to it. There's carbon-14 dating. There's epigraphy, the analysis of ancient scripts, and which have various tendencies over various ages and that sort of thing. So I would say there's a scientific side of it, but there's also a side to it which says even with all the science we have, we can't produce absolute certainty about these things through scientific analysis. So I would say text criticism is as much an art as it is in the science. And I would say it's largely reliable. I would say it's absolutely largely reliable. But that does not mean it's infallible. And that also doesn't mean that we shouldn't evaluate it critically and in a very careful way. My grandmother used to say, don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out, right? There are some scholars who would really like something to be true who unfortunately become too open-minded, too uncritical, and the result is these kinds of episodes, which unfortunately, as you seem to have suggested, tends to discredit the whole art, the whole work of text criticism, and that's unfortunate because it's certainly something we need. The task of getting back to the original form of the New Testament manuscripts is an important task, and we need to continue to pursue it.
Dr. Ben Witherington is professor of New Testament for doctoral studies at Asbury Theological Seminary. He has authored more than 40 books, including The Jesus Quest and The Paul Quest. You'll find a link to his website at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Witherington, thank you very much for your time.
You are so welcome.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time talking about a subject that we really should be discussing. It has to do with that Orlando shooting. The man who perpetrated this crime has been identified as a Muslim. Was he following Islamic teaching? And if so, what does the Quran have to say about homosexuality? What does the other historic tradition of Islam have to say about it? What does the current practice of Islam have to do with that storyline? Dr. Adam Francisco will be our guest to answer some of those questions right after this.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Help us ever to retain the catechism's doctrine plain.
What makes a church unique? Perhaps we should ask what makes a church faithful. Calvary Lutheran Church of Elgin, Illinois continually learns Christ's doctrine, simply explained in the small catechism. This doctrine teaches us Christ crucified, who even today comes and serves his baptized children in word and sacrament to forgive, strengthen, and teach us for daily life. This, Christ's own work among us, makes and keeps Calvary Lutheran Church faithful. Visit us at clce.org.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.